This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, you'll meet Colonel Lisa Lamb, the new garrison commander at Fort Hunter Liggett.
We were the only Army installation selected to give the White House a tour, of a virtual tour of what we have going on here at Fort Hunter Liggett.
Also, you'll learn about some issues facing a proposed cannabis cultivation project in Paso Robles.
It's really disheartening when the neighbors say, just simply, we want you to pack up and leave.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, August 2nd, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. In the fourth part of our 12-episode series on farm workers called Beyond the Furrows, KCBX's Francisco Martinez explores Guadalupe. It's a town where daily life goes hand in hand with agriculture.
Step inside one of Guadalupe's grocery stores, La Estrella, for instance, and you're bound to see a farm worker.
It's a really nice town, really good people. I enjoy working here, and there's a lot of hard-working people that come in here, and all around, I really appreciate the people here in Guadalupe.
That's Murad Alamari. He's been working at La Estrella for 4 years and is now a manager there. He says his customers, most of them Latino and many of them farm workers, are what make Guadalupe, Guadalupe.
Yeah, there's just a lot of hard-working people, and tremendous respect to them. They've been doing it for a lot of years, and they have great character. There's a lot of character in Guadalupe.
And if you walk a couple of blocks and head into Guadalupe's laundromat, the town's character shines through even more. Erika Lemus is the laundromat's manager. She sees farm workers come in right as the laundromat is closing, shoes covered in mud from working, asking if they can wash their clothes. Those farm workers tell her it's the only time they have to do their laundry.
Es admirante la manera.
Lemus says it's admirable the way these people work, day and night without stopping, and it doesn't matter. Lemus also says they're uplifting their families, their children, and their life goals. I spoke with several farm workers at the laundromat, none of whom wanted to be recorded, and all of whom chose to remain anonymous. One told me life as a farm worker is boring and tiring because much of his time is taken up by work. And all of them told me farm working is a hard lifestyle. One person who knows that firsthand is Ariston Julian, who grew up in the town. He worked as a farm worker, as did his family. There were minimal breaks, he says, and farm workers would work straight through their shift because they were paid by the piece.
So you had a real strong work ethic based on hard work. You'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you'd start work at 6, you work until sometimes 2 or 3 o'clock straight.
Julian is now Guadalupe's mayor and sees that work ethic in his town every day. He echoes what Lemus says. Migrant farm workers toil to support themselves and their families.
A good portion of the farm workers here, actually, when they do make money, they send it back to Mexico. So there's a strong connection between here in the United States and Mexico.
And the town's connection with Mexico continues as people migrate into the United States and into Guadalupe to make a better life for themselves.
You have a lot of farm workers that are bringing their family over from Mexico because it's still tough in Mexico. You still see that.
But Julian says it's not just Mexico that Guadalupe has a connection with. When Julian was a kid, his father was a crew boss. He remembers his dad bringing crews of Filipino farm workers to cut lettuce across the area. Julian himself is half Mexican and half Filipino. Filipino farm workers would work alongside their Mexican counterparts. That, Julian says, helped bring a sense of camaraderie and establish the foundations of Guadalupe today.
It built in us that ability to work hard, to work with people, and then to actually, because of the integration with Latinos and the Filipinos and the Portuguese and the Japanese, even today, you see Filipino friends, you see Japanese friends, you see Portuguese friends. So that built in us the ability to work with one another, and regardless of race.
Life in Guadalupe does have its problems. The mayor says homes are overcrowded because many farm workers earn low wages and can't afford to have a place of their own. On top of that, Guadalupe is a youthful town. According to Julian, the average age of a resident is 28, and 37% of the population is under 18, which means extensive youth resources are necessary and not always available. It's why education is a focus for the mayor. He's currently working to expand pre-K childcare for the town's children.
If we don't hit those kids early on, they're going to fall behind as they go through the school system.
Julian says, having grown up in Guadalupe, he's seen the various elements that have come together to make up this town. He describes Guadalupe as a big room with many doors.
These different doors are coming into the same room. So you have a mixture of different ideas, different cultures, different races, different requirements, different needs. So I think it's one of positiveness in the sense that, for the most part, we try to all work together in that one room, regardless of which door you come into.
Many of the doors Julian mentions open into the town's establishments. One of those places is the laundromat. Erika Lemus knows that.
Obviamente, todos tenemos que lavar nuestra ropa.
Obviously, everyone has to do their laundry. Next week, Beyond the Furrows returns to Guadalupe, and we'll visit Santa Maria too. But this time, we're following around a different crew. Farm worker rights organizers. For KCBX News, I'm Francisco Martinez.
Beyond the Furrows is made possible by a grant from the Sunflower Foundation. Local business Slow Cal Roots is proposing a cannabis cultivation project in Paso Robles. KCBX contributor Marcus Kukova reports.
Many in the Paso Robles area live a life of farming and agriculture, like resident Joe Capaldi.
I just live here, take care of the horses and what have you, you know, so.
Among the rolling hills, spotted with horses and covered by grapevines, some neighbors are saying trouble is sprouting on Penman Springs Road. Chandler Sujan, a horseback riding instructor, describes the situation.
The adjacent property to us, they're wanting to start a big cannabis operation. You know, they have their reasons on why they'd like that to happen, but pretty much everyone else in the neighborhood and surrounding area is pretty against it.
Sujan says she has her reasons for being opposed to the proposed project.
Here, like I said, I run lessons and teach little kids how to ride. I teach probably 20 children 3 or more days a week how to ride, and it's not very convincing to tell their parents, you know, or not even tell their parents, for their parents to see just what's going on.
For the landowners who are working to build the cultivation site, it's a different story. Brooke McCommon, her husband Pete, and Austin Canella are business partners on the project. Canella is the CEO of Slow Cal Roots, and McCommon is the CEO of the Bloomfield Company.
It's really disheartening when the neighbors say, just simply, we want you to pack up and leave. You know, this is a very thought-out project that's taken years to get here. And, you know, mine and Pete's whole relationship of 13 years has been to work towards our dream of being right here with Austin.
McCommon says she and her partners have had to make significant sacrifices to pursue their business in the cannabis industry.
We don't have access to traditional banking, and that comes, you know, with hindrances as far as the business goes, but also in our personal lives with qualifying for federally backed loans like Freddie Mac, Fannie Mac. Really every single aspect of our lives being a cannabis business owner is an uphill battle.
Because cannabis is still illegal federally, McCommon says securing financial aids like federal loans is not an option. Both McCommon and Canella say the processing of cannabis would happen at a different location, and this site on Penman Springs Road would be exclusively for growth. Other neighbors, like Christina Maldonado, say there are plenty of reasons why this project should not be approved. The first in line being
water, water, water. That's our big thing.
Maldonado says she does all she can to keep her wells from running dry.
But why is it fair that we have to do all that, and yet you let projects like this come in and, oh, it's no problem, they're going to use 24 million gallons of water, and I'm paying $1,000 a month for hay? Are you kidding me? That's just not fair. It is not fair.
Canella says he and McCommon have already addressed the neighbors' concerns in their planning, like those surrounding water usage.
For this particular project, you know, we're conditioned to actually offset our water use in the basin 2 to 1. So for every gallon of water that we use, we're actually going to have to offset or save 2 gallons of water use in the Paso Robles groundwater basin.
Maldonado is campaigning in opposition against the project by attending Board of Supervisor meetings to voice her concerns and creating materials like NoCannabisInOurBackyard.org. Other neighbors, like Terry Capaldi, say she moved Paso Robles to escape the sights of city living.
It's a dream come true being able to live in a country and no longer a concrete jungle like LA and the people and the rudeness and everything else. It took a while to slow down, but now it's it's heaven.
She says she fears that this project will deconstruct the sites of the California countryside.
Saturday, we rode just around the vineyard, and there's deer running through their places. There's coyotes. There's the kit foxes, I guess, go over there all over. You don't have that anywhere anymore. You really don't. This whole world is going to become concrete jungles, and let's just hang on to this for a little bit longer.
Austin Canella shares that he's been in the Central Coast for most of his life, and he says he would like to see his community reap the benefits of his business venture, including tourism, jobs, and tax revenue.
That passion is really what's driven me. It's driven me here locally. You know, it's my goal to give back to the community, which, you know, I live in. And I think cannabis is a powerful tool for that. I think it can not only heal people, but heal communities.
He says that for him, cannabis is much more than a way to make money.
In the last 5 years, you know, I lost both my dad and my uncle. Uncle to cancer. And, you know, through his final years, I got to watch cannabis really relieve a lot of his pain and suffering and, you know, in my opinion, help them live longer.
But Maldonado says this project makes her feel uneasy.
My heart's beating and I literally want to break down and cry because I'm so scared of this.
She says of all her concerns, those of water, odor, safety, even environmental impact, she fears her son being exposed to the potential impacts of a cultivation center above all else.
It saddens me that for maybe 8 months out of the year, in order for him to be outside, he's going to have to be exposed to those odors. I don't want that.
McCommon and Canella say they take the concerns of the community seriously and that they feel responsible for better educating those who may not understand the cannabis industry.
We've invited all the new neighbors over repetitively, asking them, you know, just come learn, let us show you. I think it, once you see the plant and actually say, oh wow, this really is just a plant, it's a lot less scary then.
As for other impacts, Canella says this farm would be no different from any other.
There'll be no outside signage indicating what's going on. There'll be no on-site consumption, no on-site sales, no on-site distribution. And so, you know, in all effects from the outside, it'll appear just like any other farm. You know, the fact that we're growing cannabis here, while the neighbors may know it, it's not going to be advertised. It's not going to be known.
McCommon says that despite the current disagreement with her neighbors, she looks forward to setting their differences aside.
At the end of the day, though, I mean, it really comes back to Christina and I are going to be neighbors for a long time. And I hope that we look back on this in a couple years and just kind of say, oh, you know, look at where we are now and just have a good relationship because... I feel like we have a lot more in common than she thinks we do.
The Board of Supervisors voted in favor of a continuation request on Tuesday, July 13th. The request was filed by the cannabis cultivators, which they say was in consideration of their neighbors. The future date for discussion for the Board of Supervisors is yet to be determined. For KCBX News, I'm Marcus Kakova.
We have two stories from King City as our Arts Beat focuses on Southern Monterey County. First, the Arts Center Soul Treasures is putting on a summer camp this year themed around Japanese culture. Staff say their goal is to introduce the idea of samurais of peace to create a positive impact in their community. KCBX's Benjamin Perper has more.
Soul Treasures was formed in 2008 by three people in King City. One of the founders, Barbara Pakema, says they formed the arts organization to fill a gap in extracurricular programs in the community.
You know, this community didn't have anything like an arts center. And so the three of us just got together and said, okay, we're going to have a gallery. We're going to do art classes. We're going to just do as much as we can. And it started with just three people putting out sign-up sheets for people who wanted classes and people who wanted to teach classes, and we just got started.
Pakema says since then, Soul Treasures has expanded a lot.
First, you couldn't get any grants because granting organizations won't give you any money until you've been in business for 3 years. So we did get one startup grant from Monterey Arts Council, thank goodness. Now I think we have 16 or 18 different granting organizations that we work with.
And now the organization's summer camp has expanded from 3 days to 2 weeks and includes kids ages 6 to 17. They also offer year-round classes and activities for all ages. Marisol Sanchez is leading the summer camp this year. She says this kind of summer camp is a huge benefit to local kids.
There is a need. There's a huge need, and I think there has been for a very long time here in the community, and I think that's why, you know, we're all doing this. We saw a need when we were young, and now everything's finally blossoming in terms of arts and culture scenes in Southern Monterey County, and it's phenomenal to be part of Soul Treasures as they're really changing the game here in town.
This year's summer camp theme is cross-cultural and ties into a major world event.
This is the year of the Japanese Olympics, the Olympics in Japan. So I'm very excited to bring some education about the culture of the country of Japan to some young folks here in town.
Part of that cultural education will include teaching kids a stretching routine called Taiso.
It's broadcast on the radio, and the whole country knows it by heart. It's broadcast on the radio 4 times a day. It's a series of very simple stretches that works out the entire body.
Sanchez, who's trained in karate, will also teach the kids karate mindfulness lessons and other mainstays of Japanese culture.
So not full-fledged karate for six-year-olds, but it's the foundation. So like deep breathing and the movements. So it'll end up being kind of like Tai Chi because we won't be, you know, fighting or doing katas or things like that. And then we'll be doing haikus. So we'll be doing poetry so that they can practice their communication skills and lots of other skills in terms of imagination and things like that, and working, collaborating with others.
Sanchez says the symbol of the samurai is an important one in this year's summer camp, but without the violence associated with it.
So we're doing a Peaceful Samurai Summer Camp. Soul Treasures Peaceful Samurai Summer Camp 2021. It's the first one, and Peaceful Samurai, because we're teaching mindfulness, and so not fighting, which I think is great because, as we all know in our community, there's a lot of gang violence. So this will be a very stark contrast. And so they'll get to learn about samurais of peace.
Jeff Hinderscheid is the executive director of Soul Treasures. He agrees with Sanchez that the samurais of peace message is an important one for kids growing up in the King City area to learn.
One of the biggest things that we could be doing right now is teaching tolerance and acceptance. And that's what a camp like this is really geared towards. Every single, like, the theme is wonderful. The collaboration of all the different instructors being on board with that, Marisol taking the lead, all of it, very beginning, has been a collaborative effort to really impart tolerance and acceptance for these young people as they go into this weird possible half school year, mask, COVID, all the stuff that's been going on.
The summer camp is ongoing, and you can learn about it and the Art Center's other efforts at soultreasures.com. For the KCBX Arts Beat, I'm Benjamin Perper.
A passion for dance pays off as King City Dancer is accepted to the Kirov Academy in Washington, D.C. KCBX's Lauren Wallachy reports.
Jeanette Harkness is a teacher and artistic director of the Monterey County Dance Theater in King City. From the moment Harkness met Madrid Oliekna, she knew she was exceptional.
I was introduced to the young lady, and when she was 3.5 years of age, she came in speaking a little bit of Russian and a little bit of Spanish, and her mom said that she wanted her to dance, and Ashley was ecstatic to dance. She wasn't quite sure what the dance involved, but she knew she wanted to do it. So in she comes, and lo and behold, since the little girl put on her ballet slippers, I knew immediately that she was something special.
But it's not just raw talent. Harkness says it takes a lot of work to get to Madrid Oliekna's skill level.
These students have to give more than people recognize to spend all those hours and hours and hours to get to the top level.
Harkness says her student had a very full schedule during the pandemic, including virtual sessions with the Kirov Academy.
When she transferred over to independent studies, she was able to take the Kirov program that began our time around 6 a.m. and would go until 1 o'clock in the afternoon and, you know, then do her independent study and then come in to take regular dance classes with us.
Madrid Oliekna says support from Harkness enabled her to grow and reach for her goals.
She was probably one of the only people that actually believed. She knew that I was capable, and she pushed me. And probably without her, I probably wouldn't have gotten this far.
Harkness says being invited to dance at the Kirov is an honor, but it's not an easy task.
That atmosphere is intense, but you're surrounded and engulfed inside of this world where the dance is at the highest level. And that's where it becomes the challenge, that highest level to reach for and to be given that opportunity to join the pre-professional program, to be invited to the company. That is a huge honor, and it is rare.
At age 15, Madrid Oliekna sees the world of dance clearly and pushes herself. She recently finished a three-week dance-intensive program in Sacramento, during which she had two injuries in her Achilles tendon.
I would just dance through the pain. Like, no matter how horrible it felt, you've got to dance through it. Yeah, I understand. My teacher was like, you know, don't push it as much because you're just agitating your Achilles. But in a sense, you know, even if it was painful, you got to keep dancing because someone might take your spot.
Madrid Oliekna says one of the misconceptions of ballet is that it's a delicate sport, but that couldn't be further from the truth.
Dance is hard. It really is. Some people don't understand. They think it's just pink tutus and prancing and doing skipping and playing with unicorns. But trust me, that's not what dance is. Dance exerts the energy out of you. But I think why dancers love this art form so much is because you just feel so much connection through dancing.
Harkness, who has known Madrid Oliekna throughout her dance career, says she couldn't be more proud to see her students' continued success.
I think for any teacher you could possibly ask, the most important thing is for the child to excel. And to excel at that level is a sheer blessing. You just are awestruck and humbled that you have worked with somebody that has that kind of a talent.
For Madrid Oliekna, it's her love and passion for dance that keeps her going despite the challenges.
When I dance, it lets me be very expressive, and I feel so passionate when I dance. Like, it's not just doing it for fun. Like, I'm just so devoted for dance, and I've invested myself all these years just to dance, and it would be such a shame for me to just, like, quit and give up on something that I put so much hard work into and I love.
Harkness says it's Madrid Oliekna's hard work and determination that has led her to where she is today.
She doesn't know the word no. She just knows that she can achieve if she tries. And that's been her mantra, and she has gone ahead and done that.
And Madrid Oliekna says her ability to achieve was inspired by Harkness and the Monterey County Dance Theater, where she learned to dance in King City. Madrid Oliekna's next goal is to dance every day to stay in shape. She is planning to attend the Kirov Academy in the fall, and Harkness is helping organize fundraisers to raise money for her education. For the KCBX Arts Beat, I'm Lauren Wallachy.
Wild beavers play a critical role in the fight against climate change by creating wetlands that combat drought and wildfire. The species is native to California, but unlike beavers in Oregon and Washington, they aren't protected from being trapped and killed in our state. KCBX's Rachel Showalter has more on their impact on the environment and how local experts are working to save the species.
Beavers have existed in North America for millions of years, with large populations in the American West. European colonization and the fur trade caused their numbers to dwindle, but they've been making a comeback in recent decades. Beavers live across California, many right here on the Central Coast, in the Salinas, Arroyo Seco, and San Ynez Rivers. Beaver expert Dr. Emily Fairfax says protecting these animals is crucial. She's a hydrologist and teaches environmental science and resource management at CSU Channel Islands. I walked with her through a beaver habitat in the Salinas River that she's been studying over the past year and a half. She says she's seen the riverbed change from dry and sandy to a productive wetland.
So like these plants here, this is all new.
Yeah.
In the last year and a half.
Mm-hmm. I mean, these ones have sprung up just since summer.
Fairfax says beaver behavior can be instrumental in helping humans address drought and wildfire, which are exacerbated by climate change.
Feel the water, feel how cool it is. When I was out here and it was like 105 degrees, the water was still about 70. It's remarkable how they can create such a stable system in the middle of a very dramatically changing climate.
She says the West has lost about 90% of its wetlands, but beavers build dams that bring back wetland and existing river ecosystems. The wetland expands the surface area of the streams and slows the flow of water, which helps restore the groundwater.
In the American West, we are in what's called a mega drought because so many places are in drought right now, and that drought is severe. When you have a mega drought, all the vegetation in the landscape is vulnerable. If it starts to run out of water, it will start to shut down.
Fairfax says beaver wetlands also create a natural barrier to fires. If one reaches the edge of a beaver habitat, the expanded wetland and moist vegetation make it difficult for the fire to spread further, at least slowing it down to make containment easier.
When you have an ignition event, when you have a lightning strike, when you have a match, when you have a campfire, when you have a power line, when any of these things happen, that's not going to turn into an out-of-control wildfire unless you have fuel. And fuel isn't really fuel unless it's dry.
Fairfax says people sometimes find themselves in conflict with beavers because the animals may move into areas that create problems for landowners. They can cause unintentional flooding of property and chew down trees and bushes, but there are mitigation tactics that can be used to help humans coexist with beavers. Cooper Linehart is a Cal Poly graduate and currently getting a certification to practice non-lethal beaver management.
Yeah, I'll be able to help any landowners if they got beaver problems. I can wrap their trees so they don't get chewed down. You can actually like run a pipe through a beaver dam and control the height so that beavers can keep building up their dam, but the pond won't get any higher. So the beavers can stay living there and won't have to worry about flooding damage.
Linehart says he is considering approaching property owners adjacent to the Salinas River beaver habitat in Atascadero to see if there is any work he can do for them to make cohabitation possible. He says this kind of work is really important in California because state law currently classifies beavers as pests, making it illegal to move them. So if a landowner is in conflict with beavers, the only options are mitigation tactics or trapping and killing. Legislation in Oregon and Washington allows for the relocation of beavers from human-occupied areas to more suitable habitat throughout the state. Fairfax is hopeful legislation will change in California to allow for the legal movement of beavers so they can continue to reduce the impacts of climate across the state.
There are beavers in downtown San Jose. There are beavers in San Diego. There are beavers that move onto military bases. Those aren't really great places for the beavers. It's not good for their survival, and it's definitely not good for the people who own that land. But they can't be moved. So in that case, California does still issue lethal trapping permits for nuisance beavers.
Last year, the number of beavers trapped across the state was estimated to be between 1,000 and 2,500. Fairfax says this is problematic because as long as beavers are keeping up their dam, the wetland remains. But as soon as they're removed, the habitat can change.
And at that point, when the beavers leave, this will go right back to being a degraded system.
The San Luis Obispo Beaver Brigade is a local beaver advocacy group. They hold regular beaver walks for the public to see the animals' habitat firsthand. You can find out more about how to get involved on our website at kcbx.org. For KCBX News, I'm Rachel Showalter.
And now, KCBX contributor Tom Wilmer has a conversation with Colonel Lisa Lamb, the new garrison commander at Fort Hunter Liggett.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett in Monterey County. Come along and join us for a visit with Colonel Lisa Lamb, the new garrison commander. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. So, rewind in your life for a moment. You just came from duty station in Germany, correct?
I did. Stuttgart, Germany. Wow. With U.S. Africa Command.
That's different, isn't it?
Yeah. Very different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what was primary mission focus for you while you're there in Germany?
So my primary duty responsibility was as the secretariat for the joint staff to the commander there at AFRICOM, which was General Townsend.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And rewinding more in your life, you originally got out of high school and joined the Air Force as an enlisted.
I did. Yeah. I did. So I had a pretty interesting journey. I went into the Air Force right out of high school, mostly for my, to get the college.
GI Bill.
GI
yeah.
Bill, absolutely.
Yeah.
And from there, after I left the Air Force, I decided to go back to school mm-hmm. because that was the intent. Huh. And while I was in college at Christopher Newport University, I ended up running into a major there who was running around the campus looking for students to join his ROTC program, Army ROTC. Mm-hmm. And the rest is history. That's how I ended up in the Army.
So it was coincidence. It could have been an Air Force colonel that taught you.
It could have.
Right.
It could have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So your career field, your MOS, changed dramatically when you went into the Army?
Well, actually, it didn't right away. So initially, I went into the Army as a logistician. And in the Air Force, I was an inventory control specialist, very similar.
Okay.
However, as a senior major, I transitioned to what we call a functional area, and that functional area is force management. So that's when the change occurred, when I went into force management.
And then how did it segue to Germany? How did that happen?
So the Germany assignment came along after Army War College. I spent a year at Army War College, and then I was selected to go back to the Pentagon and work on the Joint Staff.
Wow.
But I got a phone call, ironically. I was about to board a cruise ship. One of my middle girls, my daughter Jillian, had just graduated from high school, and I was with my dad and my brother, one of my brothers, and the whole family, and we were walking onto the cruise ship, and I got a phone call from my career manager that said, "Hey, have you signed in yet to the Pentagon?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I signed in." "Well, how many days have you been there? Like, have you unpacked?" And I'm like, "Where is this going?" And all of a sudden she goes, "Well, I've got an opportunity for you. I know you kind of mentioned you wouldn't mind going back overseas. What do you think about Germany?" And I was like, "Say no more. Yes." "I'll take it, whatever the job is." And that's how I ended up
in Stuttgart. What year was that?
2018.
2018. 2018. So you were there last 20
3 years.
Three years. Wow.
Last 3 years. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Do you miss it at all?
A little bit. I do. I miss
the
all
culture
of the culture and just it's kind of simpler there. Mm-hmm. You know, I rode my bike to work every day and just some of the things that I did in Germany. It was different. But I have to be honest, you know, I feel like probably the luckiest girl in the world. I went from Germany to one of the best places, I believe, in the United States to live in, and that's Central California.
That's really cool.
It is gorgeous here.
Did you have a choice in your new assignment? Actually,
very similar story to my going to Germany assignment. So I was already selected to be the director for distance education at Fort Leavenworth for the Command and General Staff College.
Oh, wow.
And because of my educational background and I've taught before, I interviewed for that job back in January of this year and was selected and was, I actually had an offer out on a house and had finished the inspection on the house when I got a strange phone call again that said, "Hey, we want to talk to you about a command opportunity." And I was like, "Are you kidding me right now?" Like, this cannot be happening again.
How funny.
And thank goodness I was within that 10-day window of the whole home buying process in Kansas. And they told me that it was Fort Hunter Liggett, and my family and I, we sat down, we looked it up on the map, and we were like, "There's nothing there. Do we really want to take this?" And we all decided it looked like a great adventure. And so, you know, you can't turn down a command opportunity either.
I know your uncle is in Oakland.
He has
some family on the West Coast.
I do, and I thought it was a great opportunity. We've never lived in California. Mm-hmm. I've never had the opportunity to be so close to, you know, my dad's side of the family, my uncle and cousins that are here. I just thought it seemed like a great opportunity.
And as long as we're talking things Central Coast, Frank Lanzone, the general manager at KCBX, had met you.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Lisa loves wine."
Absolutely. It is no secret that my husband and I love wine tasting.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, during COVID, while we were in Germany and we couldn't go down to visit some of our favorite spots in Italy and the Bordeaux region and all of those great places we had visited before COVID, our MWR there in Stuttgart started virtual wine tastings.
Wow.
And they would link up with the vineyards in Italy and France and
little Zoom.
It was a Zoom call, and they would purchase a package in advance,
mm-hmm.
and they would send the box to you, and then you could do the virtual Zoom with the vineyards. And man, we probably did one of those every couple of weeks. And we started hosting parties, so we love wine tasting.
That's so cool. So you're a little spoiled.
A little bit. But we're looking forward to all the California wines.
Have you had a chance to get off base and do a little tasting yet?
Not yet. My husband is visiting with his mom in Albuquerque right now, and he made me promise that I wouldn't hit the vineyards until he got back.
I love it.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. Contributor Tom Wilmer is speaking with Colonel Lisa Lamb, the new garrison commander at Fort Hunter Liggett.
What first was your, oh my God, you know, what am I, what
when,
am I dealing
when my
with?
Daughter and I first drove in, it was the 19th of June, I believe, and we were coming down from San Jose. We flew into San Jose the night before. And we're driving in that morning, and we keep driving. And at one point, I call Lieutenant Colonel Stanley, and I said, I don't know if I've missed the – I got off the exit, but maybe I missed the sign or something. He's like, ma'am, just keep driving. You'll eventually see it. I was like, wow, this is kind of far. Yeah. But as we drove in, and we could see the mountains and everything, I just – it's breathtaking. It is absolutely breathtaking. And even though it's way out here, there's just so much that we have to offer.
And you've got a back way out on the Nacimiento Ferguson Road. You can hit the beach at Big Sur in, what, a half hour,
oh,
an hour?
Yes. Yeah. Probably. Mm-hmm. Probably, yeah.
Back to mission here. Mm-hmm. What are your challenges? What are you getting your teeth into now in here?
I think some of the challenges are probably – you know, coming, well, I don't want to say coming out of COVID. We're mm-hmm. still in COVID, but right. kind of the post, you know, pandemic shutdown, just trying to get our services back. And also we've done a lot of training here this summer. We've had a lot of, units come through. And I think just getting back to business as we've, you know, had in the past.
Kind of that regular routine, yeah.
Absolutely.
But this is very much a training base.
Absolutely.
And you have schoolhouse and schools that go on 24/7 here.
Absolutely.
Right?
We have had schools that still continue during the pandemic.
And one is military police, right?
Yes. So we have military police, we have the engineers, so a number of different schools here.
Mm-hmm. One of the most fascinating things about the base here that I'm just in love with is your cyber virtual reality laboratories that you have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we have the opportunity to train on so many different career fields within the Army right here at Fort Hunter Liggett or up at our other installation in Dublin at Camp Parks.
So that is very much a part of the umbrella of Fort Hunter Liggett.
It is. So Camp Parks just recently got the NCO Academy there. And so as a part of, we're one garrison, two installations, and as a part of one garrison, we're able to do quite a bit of training for the Army.
And do you have to physically go up there periodically? Is that part of your regular?
I do. I go up and visit. We were just there last Friday.
Swing by and see Uncle on the way back.
Absolutely.
Well, a little bit more about what you're most proud of and what you hope to accomplish. Your mission here. Yeah.
The mission here. I think what's really neat about the mission here is, again, the fact that we can train so many different MOSs and we have the land and the space to do that. But also the fact that we have this microgrid project and we will reach net zero in probably the next 12 to 15 months or so. The first Army installation to do that.
So you guys literally are a role model and kind of a demonstration model for other installations and military bases, Department of Defense, all across the country.
And the U.S. government, to be quite honest. We're at a point where we will produce more energy than we consume. And, you know, our focus here is to do just that in the next 12 months or so.
That's really interesting. There is that other silent mission of the Army Reserve here, and it's like, you guys are environmentalists.
Absolutely.
It's kind of a disconnect in a way.
Yeah.
But, I mean, with your natural habitat and wildlife.
We run our own recycling program. I mean, we do a lot here at Fort Hunter Liggett, and it's just amazing. The professionals that work here every day, again, I sometimes want to pinch myself that I was lucky enough to get this assignment and work with this team. Another, you know, point to make is we were the only Army installation selected to give the White House a tour of a virtual tour of what we have going on here at Fort Hunter Liggett.
And that was just what, last week?
Or? 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, yes. So again, there's so much happening here at Fort Hunter Liggett, and I think it's a crown jewel, not only the Army Reserve, but our Army in total.
And it's really fascinating, as you alluded to earlier. It's kind of an invisible base.
Right, it really is.
Unless you drive down 101, you don't see it.
Right.
And yet, as I recall, this is the largest Army Reserve training installation in America.
It is. We are the seventh largest Army base. So at 169,000 acres, we're a pretty big deal. I think Fort Hunter Liggett is a pretty big deal.
That's really cool. Mm-hmm. Looking forward, what do you hope to accomplish, you know, even community engagement?
Oh, so that is right now my absolute passion. I'm looking to be engaged more within our community. And again, coming out of this global pandemic, I think we need to do more within the community. And so we have a number of initiatives that we're looking at as we reach out. We did a huge 4th of July event that went over well. I think it was absolutely phenomenal, actually. It was the first of its kind for our installation, and the teamwork that went into that to make that thing successful. We had, I think, approximately 1,700 people attended the event.
Wow.
And it was awesome. We've heard nothing but great things, and we're looking to do more outreach like that. So
I wanted to come, but I was at 30,000 feet. And it was interesting. Flying over America on July 4th in the evening, it was like carpet bombing Germany.
Was it really?
Oh, it was unbelievable.
Wow.
Looking at the whole Midwest.
Everything.
Just, yeah. Anyway, back to Lisa Lamb, Colonel, Commander of the base. We skipped over your family, and I was blessed to have lunch with some of your family at ceremony for change of command.
Yeah.
Your brother, retired colonel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some awesome characters. Give us a highlights of what you're most proud of your family.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, my brother, Raymond Lamb, retired colonel and now a deacon within the Catholic Church. And he has just been such a mentor.
Yeah, he told me he changed to saving lives.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Such a mentor to me over the past few years.
Is he older brother?
Oh, yes, he is. We lived in Hawaii for about 6 years. And my husband and I spent a lot of time with he and my sister-in-law, Tyra. And then there's my uncle David Krashna, who's here in California. And I'll tell you, he was my role model when I was that high. I actually wanted to go into the military to become a lawyer. I wanted to become a lawyer and then eventually, you know, go on and do things that he did.
And he was retired Superior Court judge, correct?
Yes, yeah. He is. And that didn't work out for me, but I think I've been successful nonetheless. He has been definitely a role model, and that's why I'm really happy to have an opportunity to be close by and spend some time with him
the next few years.
Yeah.
Colonel Lisa Lamb, Garrison Commander, Fort Hunter Liggett in Monterey County, wonderful to spend the morning with you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And finally, Working Lunch.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the SLO Chamber's weekly series where we connect with the leaders in our community who are doing exciting things in our area. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO of the San Luis Chamber, and today we'll be having a conversation with Andrea Luker, Harbor Manager for Port San Luis Harbor District. Port San Luis, you know, the water area around Avila Beach. Andrea began her career on the Central Coast, spending 27 years working for the City of Morro Bay, seven of those as city manager. After leaving the City of Morro Bay, Andrea spent time as the executive director of a newly formed nonprofit that worked to provide historic fishing privileges along the Central Coast. Then in 2015, the Port San Luis Harbor District hired her to take over as harbor manager, and she's served in that role ever since. So I always like to start by learning a little bit more about how people's career path started.
My father was a microbiologist, and he did a lecture series at San Diego State University. And so it was the first time that we got to see the Pacific Ocean. We grew up in Colorado. And so at that point, I knew that I was going to end up in California by the ocean. It took me another, 20 years to relocate and just started kind of the slow progression through positions. And I'm not sure there's anybody that's decided that they're, at the end of the day, they're going to be a harbor manager, but certainly with the experience I got in municipalities, I think it was kind of a natural progression.
It occurs to me that many people might not know what a harbor district does. Maybe you can share a bit of what makes up the Port San Luis Harbor District and what operations are under the harbor's jurisdiction.
Sure. I have an elevator speech for that about, your job must be really great because you're probably on the boat all day. So it's not exactly like that, but we do get on boats. So the Harbor District is a special district. We're a governmental entity. Our boundaries basically go from much of San Luis Obispo, the city of San Luis Obispo, down to the county line and then east. So it's estimated about 90,000 people within our Harbor District boundaries. So those are the people, if you're a registered voter, you'll see a little line to vote for Port San Luis Harbor Commissioners. And so all of those people within our district boundaries are part of the district. The property that we have is much smaller. We have Port San Luis and we have the Avila Pier, the Avila Beach, and the Avila parking lot, and then Old Port Beach. So property-wise, we're pretty small, but boundary-wise, we're large. I think the best description, and maybe it was because of my previous municipal experience, but I think the best description of what a harbor manager does is it's really like a city manager, very similar to what a city manager does. I work for 5 elected board of commissioners that represent our district. Then working for me, I have 3 department heads, a business manager, a facilities manager, and a chief harbor patrol officer. And then under those people, there are additional staff. We're pretty small. We're about 26 staff total and about a $6 million budget. But we really operate a lot like a city. We have board of commissioner meetings. We have to abide by a lot of the same regulations that cities do. That's probably the best description that I can give you.
So what's a typical day like for you? Is it, Point Break or Baywatch or nothing like that at all?
It's kind of a combination. It's a lot of working with the public. We deal with a fair amount of regulatory agencies. The California Coastal Commission has jurisdiction when we do something on Harford Pier or on any part of the port that was originally in the water. Then the county has permitting jurisdiction for some of our other projects. We also work with the Army Corps of Engineers. I almost feel like a typical day is atypical, trying to figure out what projects we're going to get done. We pass a budget, and then the tsunami comes or the whales happen to be in the port.
There was a day that the tide really pulled out far, so people couldn't launch, and it might have been the opening of fishing season. And so you were getting calls like somehow you could influence the tide. But what's the weirdest question or questions you've received as harbor manager?
Probably the two that stick out. We are visited by whales on their migration paths. That happens when there's a lot of feed in the water. So the birds come in, the whales come in. It's a quiet spot for them. And we get a fair amount of whales. But we do get a lot of questions about, hey, are the whales going to come in today? Not are the whales there, because we will answer that question anytime anybody wants to know. Absolutely. If you call us and there are whales here, we'll let you know. But we haven't gotten really good on whale whispering yet. And so we're not sure when they're going to come in, besides the fact that they're in migration. So that's a positive and kind of funny question. And we do have a lot of fun with that question with the general public. And then I'll share the one other one that's not quite so funny, but somewhat horrifying. We have marine mammals and they're big. And so we have sea lions that pop up on some of our landings. And a parent wanted to have their 8-month-old baby propped up on the shoulder of the sea lion for a picture. And, they wanted to know if that was okay. It's like posing with a wild moose, probably not a good idea. So those kinds of questions.
Hopefully soon you'll be able to work with the calendaring person for the whales. That's so funny that people think somehow are they coming in today?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think the calendar person for the whales is the same one that calendars the mermaids. So as soon as we've got the whales, we'll definitely deal with the mermaids.
Perfect. Well, that'll be helpful. Is there a major misconception of the work you do?
I think there's a strange idea of what we do. And that's why I generally compare it to a city, because a lot of people understand how cities run. And so especially with a governmental special district. The other question that I've had before is it a full-time job? I always like to say, definitely, it's a full-time job. And then I think people are sometimes a little bit nervous about asking what happens in a port and what do you do? We're going to keep working on education.
One of those pieces is the Harbor Patrol, right, that you oversee and that you work with. What is their role or jurisdiction?
The Harbor Patrol is a unique breed of law enforcement because they do enforce laws. They spend a lot of time on the water, and they also spend a lot of time on land. So we do have an armed Harbor Patrol department. We have 6 officers. They do both marine and land enforcement. And then we do have a really great relationship with our allied agencies, such as the county sheriff and CAL FIRE and the Highway Patrol, because there are things that we don't do. We don't transport people to, let's say, the county jail or anything like that. So we work together. It is great to have a Harbor Patrol law enforcement here because we are at the end of the road and we do have a lot of, a lot of people that come in and out. One of the things that we really focus on, though, with our Harbor Patrol, which I think makes us a little bit different than, let's just say, a police officer, is the education. I'm guessing that our chief, Matt Ashton, would probably say that 75% of his day might be just educating people about things in the harbor and, what you can do and what you can't do and what you shouldn't do.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. The San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona is speaking with the Port San Luis Harbor District Manager, Andrea Luker.
Port San Luis underwent a master plan update in 2007. That document laid out the plan for the future of Port San Luis.
Probably in the next couple of years, going to be doing an update to our master plan. So probably the biggest project, probably the Harbor Terrace project, which is the development of our 32-acre site on the hill that the district has owned for about 40 years. So that coming to fruition, a couple months probably, that's probably one of the biggest changes that we see in the from the master plan that we currently have. The rehabilitation of the Avila Pier and, in the master plan, it talks about keeping the infrastructure updated. So I think the Avila Pier, continuing working on lease sites on the Harford Pier. So the Harford Pier is the pier that is at the end of the road here at Port San Luis. It's our commercial pier, commercial fishermen, as well as lease sites, restaurants, and that sort of thing. So just keeping those up and going. Those are probably the Harbor Terrace is the biggest. And then maybe the other one is the federal breakwater that we have, maintaining that federal breakwater, making sure we find the money to maintain the federal breakwater.
Probably one of the most visible ones is the Avila Pier.
We're really happy to say that we are going before the California Coastal Commission either in August or September for our coastal development permit. And we need to get a special coastal development permit for that pier because we're going to be likely driving piles to do the repairs. The pier's open about halfway now. The pier's long. It's 1,600 plus feet. Once we get the coastal development permit, which we are feeling positive about, then we'll finalize our repair plan. If everything goes well, we'll hope to start the repair work maybe this fall on the Avila Pier, which would be fantastic to be able to walk out to the very end of the pier and be out over the water, which is some people's only opportunity to get on the water. So it's really important.
Maybe one of the most gorgeous views in all of the Central Coast is your spot out at Harbor Terrace. And I know that was a project that got underway prior to COVID, but obviously a little delayed. Can you tell us a little bit about Harbor Terrace?
It's an interesting project. When I came to the district about 6 years ago, we had just entered into some negotiations with Red Tail Acquisitions, which is developer operator for that project. So it's a 32-acre site. It's going to be about 155 accommodations, which is a combination of RV pads, RV cabins, and then tent camping, walk-in and car tent camping. So lots of different opportunities. And that was one of the camping aspect was one of the issues that led us to be able to get the coastal development permit for the project because we have affordable waterside accommodations. So at the end of the day, about 155, 160 accommodations, they are close to a soft opening probably on or about August 16th. And that's only going to be open for walk-in reservations. So I'm going to say that quietly, but the grand opening is slated for sometime in September, and they are doing a phased development. So all those 155, 60 sites won't be available immediately. At the end of the day, there'll be a swimming pool and some really incredible amenities. So it's a pretty amazing project. It's been a long time. It's been a twinkle in the port's eye for, you know, 42 years. We're close.
Your predecessor, Steve McGraw, and the board of directors at that time really focused to try and get that done, because I'm sure that was a heavy lift, because I know how heavy the lift has been for you to just get it from that point to this point.
I'm glad I didn't have to do what Steve had to do, his part. I'm glad he did that, and I'm glad I got to do what I got to do, but it's been great teamwork.
That will open up new spaces for camping in the Avila area. How will that implement the current setup for spaces allocated for camping? Because aren't some along the road?
We've got a couple of pop-outs, and those have dry camping. So as soon as the project is done and everything is finished, then the Coastal Commission back in 2011 said to the district, you know, you've got to move those. Those sites can no longer be camping. So those will go away eventually. And there's not a specific plan for those two areas, but I'm guessing it'll be day use, but no overnight camping. There's also overnight camping in the port, and we've got probably about 17 or 18 spaces, and those will stay, and those are with hookups. And those are for specifically if you have a boat and a trailer for some of those spots, and other spots you don't need to. So we'll still have some camping. Nobie and Woodyard will go away, and Harbor Terrace will have the lion's share of the camping.
It looks like the harbor has some unique offerings in Port San Luis that many locals might not know about.
I think people are probably familiar with sport fishing. We have Patriot Sport Fishing. So we have a hagfish fishery, and it's a live fish fishery, and it's at the end of the pier. And it's not a fishery that's open to the public, but the slime eels are some amazing critters, I'll just say. And that's been in the port for probably four or five years, specifically in that site.
And if folks have never, ever seen anything about a slime eel or a hagfish, just look it up online. It is one of the strangest things I've ever seen, but it's right here in Avila, right here in the port.
And then something we just added probably 6 months ago, is the opportunity for the commercial fishermen to sell their own catch in a fisherman's market. It's really, if you think farmer's market and put in the word fisherman, it's really the same thing. They can show up with their catch. They can sell it. We've allowed them, we're letting them at this point in a pilot project, use one of our empty buildings on the end of the pier in the interim, and they can sell what they've caught. And it's nice because you then can walk out and you can talk to Tom about what are you catching? Which vessel is yours? Where did you get this? And it's kind of nice. That's been very popular. It's currently Wednesdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. And it's going pretty well. Jim, the other thing that we're going to open up probably probably around Labor Day is that we have a new fish market, Harford Pier Fish Market, which is going to be just opposite from the commercial fisherman's market. And it's going to be more of your typical retail fish markets.
Yeah. Maybe you could talk about what this past year and a half has been like for the port.
Looking back on the COVID pandemic, I think it's probably one of the most challenging that I've ever experienced in my, almost 35 years now of public service. We were very busy. It was the never-ending summer. I think those months of March and April of 20 were challenging because we were struggling with what we needed to close and what we needed to open and what restrictions we needed to put in place. For the most part, we stayed open. All the employees were here because we were all considered essential. The businesses were really flexible about following the precautions, and we did some outdoor dining and some expansion of people's areas so they could still stay afloat. A lot of people on the beach, we brought in some lifeguards a little bit more often than typical. And the district took a pretty significant hit, a total of about $800,000 between revenues and expenses, but we got through it. We were just busy, and we joke about the summer never ending, and it's still happening, which is great. I think a lot of people got to experience Port San Luis that maybe never would have.
Yeah, it definitely felt that you guys did a great job managing a very difficult time, right? With crowds, with people, with a lot of folks maybe finding it for the first time, not knowing the rules, whatever. So maybe new people found boats and new people learned how to launch and all of those fun things.
We always encourage people to pop in the office, to give me a call. We're all on the website, portsanluis.com. The more we can tell you about Port San Luis and what we do, the better it is.
That was the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona speaking with the Port San Luis Harbor District Manager, Andrea Luker. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.